Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. I know it's a scary time. I'm recording this from the self-isolation of my own home, where I imagine a lot of you will be listening to it. So hang in there with us. Thanks to everybody who participated in our special call-in with Death, Sex, and Money about how we're all coping right now. If you missed that, it's in your feed. Scroll back and listen. Maybe it'll be helpful. We're, of course, thinking about how we can continue to use this show best in this moment, and we'll have more on that later. But we know the coronavirus has already upended our lives, our families, our already fractured health system, our economy for sure. It's overwhelming. And one thing we know from history is that we need to be very careful about how we react in moments like these. Great things can happen, but also awful ones. We began this season with Reconstruction, a moment in history after the Civil War when we had to really totally rebuild our society. We will continue thinking about that time in this show, but for now, I'm thinking about a more recent moment in which millions of Americans felt overwhelmed and worried about the future. Because right now, even as all kinds of crises unfold around us, there's an effort to get justice for the horrible things some people did after another crisis. I'm Kai Wright, and this is The United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future. Seventeen years ago this week, a U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq. The war didn't just divide Americans, it divided the world. And we're still living with the repercussions.
Good evening. We're coming on the air with breaking news. The Pentagon confirming that Iran has launched a series of ballistic missiles targeting American forces in Iraq.
With around a half dozen explosions, the Americans firing with drones clearly didn't want to miss their target. Iran's general, Qasem Soleimani.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
But there is one aspect of the Iraq war, and the war in Afghanistan too, for that matter, that we don't hear so much about anymore. Iraq was a test case for how the U.S. military could engage in conflicts using private contractors on an unprecedented scale. In both Afghanistan and Iraq, there were just as many private contractors as members of the U.S. military. And pretty early on in Iraq, it became clear that these private contractors had very few checks on how they behaved while fighting in our name. In this episode, we bring you the story of one man, an Iraqi who came face to face with the atrocities of the war and the private contractors who helped fight it, and how he is still trying to get justice for what happened to him.
Standing there naked, I felt paralyzed. They had full power over me. And I even thought that they were capable of killing me anytime and throwing my corpse aside.
It is a dark moment in our history, one that many of us thought we'd fully reckoned with. But we speak with someone who was in Iraq as a contractor, who says he and many others were never held to account for the crimes they committed.
If there is a prosecutor out there that is going to make a case to prosecute Khaki or for any of his employees for torture, then I am the easiest case.
And we want to warn you beforehand that this episode contains graphic depictions of torture and sexual assault. Seth Fried-Wessler, a reporter with Type Media Center, has the story.
Welcome in.
Hi, thank you. Hi. Seth, great to meet you.
Welcome.
First, I want to introduce you to a family living far from the place they'd always called home.
Yeah. Okay, my name is Salah Hassan. I am from Iraq.
Salah Hassan Nusayf Al-Ajali is from a province just outside Baghdad.
But now I am in Sweden, in Västerås city.
He and his wife Amal and their three kids.
How are you?
Taqwa, Gaith, and Mustafa.
Seth, Mustafa.
They moved to Sweden as refugees. And the thing about Sweden, at the time I visited them in the spring and summer, is that the days are really, really long.
This one never sets.
Yeah. Like more than 20 hours long. And it was Ramadan, which means they were fasting for 20 hours.
So we have rice.
So we were in the kitchen
with the soup,
preparing all of this delicious food that we'd eat in a couple of hours.
A fact about the soup, we do it every single night of Ramadan.
And the kids, all they could talk about was the meal they were going to eat.
One of my favorite things to do with the rice, I take ketchup and put it on it, and then take potatoes and put on it, and the little pieces of noodles, and then I put it on it and I eat it all.
This is a really lovely family. They're effusive. They're laughing together all the time, trying to find work, learning a new language.
What time is school in the morning?
Usually 8:30.
Yeah.
And they're here. Ultimately, because of
the U.S. warships and planes,
the war in Iraq,
the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
When President Bush,
on my orders,
George W. Bush, announced the American invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, Salah was working in Diyala, a province where he's from, in a machine shop. Amal was working as a teacher there. They had a newborn baby. Taqwa had just been born.
The people you liberate will witness the honorable and decent spirit of the American military.
And as anyone who remembers this time will remember, there was widespread condemnation of this war all over the world. And in Iraq, the resistance emerged soon after the Americans invaded.
Some embassy staff, uninjured by the blast, were chased by the mob.
And at the start of it all, Salah was looking for some way to do something meaningful in this terrifying period in his country. And he saw this job posting to be a reporter at Al Jazeera, the TV network based in Qatar. Al Jazeera was hiring lots of people as reporters in Iraq to cover the war. And they were hiring people who sometimes didn't have all that much experience as reporters. And he got the job, basically as a cameraman and field reporter. And right away, after a bit of training, he was sent out to report on major incidents of violence, explosions, generally the sort of chaos that was erupting around the region that he was from.
See, we have medevac birds on site.
He was out reporting all the time. So, at least in his community, in Diyala, people knew him. He was the local reporter. And then, one day in November of 2003, Salah went to cover a bombing in the city of Bukuba. He speaks mostly in Arabic, so we hired a translator.
The explosion was not directed at American forces, but it was, I think, directed at a local politician. So me, along with other outlets, such as France Press and Reuters, we went there to cover the story. And I was there filming the car that had exploded. I even interviewed one local politician who was there. I was talking to people and filming the surrounding site.
When I sat down to talk with Salah about this moment, he said that as he was doing all of this reporting, there were also members of the American military police at this site. And they asked all these reporters to gather around, and they began to ask them questions.
We were about 5-6 journalists, and we lined up, and I was third in the line. And when my turn came, he asked my name and which TV station I represent. And when I said my name and that I work for Al Jazeera, he said, you're under arrest. And when I said, why? He said, you know why.
At first, Salah thought this must be a mistake. But at this point in the Iraq war, just a mere 8 months into the invasion, the U.S. had begun broadening who it considered to be the enemy. And Al Jazeera, which was one of the leading, if not the leading, Arabic news outlets,
the most watched TV outlet in the Middle East,
had been reporting on the gruesome facts of the war.
Its non-stop coverage of conflicts and uncensored talk shows
had become this kind of target of the Bush administration.
We know that Al Jazeera has a pattern of playing propaganda.
Donald Rumsfeld, then the Secretary of Defense, had falsely claimed that Al Jazeera was fabricating stories about civilian casualties, that it was acting as Al-Qaeda's mouthpiece.
What they do is when there's a bomb goes down, they grab some children and some women and pretend that the bomb hit the women and the children. And
it's Al Jazeera offices both in Iraq and Afghanistan had been bombed.
And the United States hit that office and killed Tariq Ayub.
And in Salah's case, he was pulled out of that press scrum, and he was taken to a place that he'd only ever heard horrors about for years.
Abu Ghraib prison, where Saddam Hussein subjected prisoners to hideous torture.
Abu Ghraib was an Iraqi prison that stood for Saddam Hussein's brutality.
There are bodies that were eaten by dogs, torture, you know, electrodes coming out of walls, scratches on the wall.
It was a place where people disappeared.
Iraqis were too afraid to come to Abu Ghraib and ask for information on their family members.
But then, after the invasion, after the U.S. invaded and occupied the country, the Americans made the jail into their own prison. And when Salah was detained there, one of the first things that happened to him was that the Americans stripped him naked.
They were shouting that I should confess, confess. And I asked, confess to what? They said, you know what, confess to everything. After I was forced to remove my clothes, they placed a black bag over my head. They tied my hands together behind my back, and I was left outside from the evening until the morning. That first night, I heard the American outside singing Happy Birthday Al Jazeera. And that's when I understood that this arrest concerns me and Al Jazeera coverage of the country.
He spent 6 weeks inside of Abu Ghraib, where he was interrogated, asked questions about Al Jazeera, about why he worked there, hearing suggestions that he must know something about the insurgency. And inside, he was treated horrifically. He says that he thinks that something like 80% of the time he was detained in Abu Ghraib, that he was held in the cell with no clothes on. His arms were often chained to a post above his head, unable to move, being threatened by an aggressive military dog barking, growling at him.
Especially when you have the dog is approaching you and you are in handcuff, you cannot do anything about it. Standing there naked, I felt paralyzed. They had full power over me. And I even thought that they were capable of killing me anytime and throwing my corpse aside. It was very painful to hear prisoners screaming in pain and realizing that your turn will come to be tortured and beaten, knowing that was going to be you to be tormented. That was very painful.
Salah said every 2 or 3 days he'd be interrogated. He didn't know exactly who was questioning him. He was often hooded. Those he could see, some were in military uniform, some were in civilian clothes. And what we now know is that the interrogations inside of Abu Ghraib, they were carried out not only by members of the American military, but also by employees of a private contractor, an American company called CACI.
This is CACI,
which had been paid millions of dollars
America's priorities are our priorities.
To provide interrogation services inside these American military prisons.
For interrogation, the regular army soldier would take us and deliver us to these people and just leave us with them and just hand us over into their hands. It was very apparent that they had another kind of power and authority than the regular military.
And one of the things Saleh remembers is that while he was chained inside of that cell, he vomited on the floor in front of him. And then he was ordered by somebody to use the orange jumpsuit that he'd been given as his only piece of clothing to wipe up the vomit on the floor. He was then told to put the jumpsuit back on.
One of the moments that always come back to me is the feeling of being observed, looked at as if we were animals in a zoo. This is what I felt in the prison.
While he was detained, he didn't know anything about what anybody knew outside. He didn't know if he would ever get out of there. He says that, you know, on days when it was sunny, there would be just a sliver of light that would shine into the cell where he was held, and that was sort of his measurement of a day passing.
The spot was about half a meter, and it would only appear for 30 minutes. And I tried to step into that spot and move with the light so I can feel the sun. I can feel something from the outside world. And I would track that spot until the sunlight disappeared.
And then, at the end of December 2003, Saleh was just released. He was driven out of Abu Ghraib and dumped on a street outside of Baghdad and left there. And then he went home to Amal, his wife, and their baby daughter back in Diyala.
Can you tell me about when he came home? Can you tell me about that moment?
When I heard, I couldn't believe the news because they told us that the people who were taken to Abu Ghraib, they might spend years or at least many months there. When he did get out, he was completely transformed. It was like it was half of my husband. His head was shaven. He approached Taqwa and saying, "Daddy, I'm here." And she didn't respond to him. But I remember being joyful that day, I think more joyful than I was on our wedding day. When I first saw him, I saw that he was still alive, that he was still with us.
And when he got out, he said his editors at Al Jazeera asked him to file a memo on what had happened to him. And when they read it, they were in disbelief.
They couldn't believe that any of this could be true. Even journalists couldn't believe how could such an incident happen without us knowing about it.
Saleh felt that what had happened to him was just his to bear, that since he had no hard proof, nobody would ever really believe him. But then, in April 2004...
This is a picture of an Iraqi prisoner of war.
CBS News in the United States runs this story about Abu Ghraib.
The army confiscated some 60 pictures of Iraqi prisoners being mistreated.
And releases these images of people being tortured inside of that American prison.
We want to warn you, the pictures are difficult to look at.
These are the images that probably have been most burned into all of our minds about the Iraq war.
Americans did this to an Iraqi prisoner.
The image of a man, a hood over his head, standing on a box with his arms outstretched and electrical wires attached to his fingers.
According to the U.S. Army, he was told that if he fell off the box, he would be electrocuted.
There's an image of a stack of naked men who'd been forced to create a pyramid, one on top of another.
In some, the male prisoners are positioned to simulate sex with each other.
And in those photographs are members of the American military holding on to leashes,
posing with naked Iraqi prisoners,
smiling in pictures of people being abused in the most terrible of ways.
Arab TV labeled the acts atrocities.
These images are splashed across the world's television screens.
Headlines around the world screamed torture.
And suddenly, everybody sees it. It's impossible to not believe it. When you first saw those images, what was that like?
الأول أنه نعم هذا اللي كنت أنا أتحدث عنه وما كان أحد مصدق.
When the images surfaced, it confirmed that this actually happened to me, where nobody believed me because I had no proof. So now I could see, these are the facts. Second, everything was coming back to me. The insult, the beating, the pain started to emerge again.
ما شفت الصور كان أنا نازلت في داخل السجن.
Like it rushed back in.
كان ما عايش في نفس المكان.
Yes, every single second came back. It was as if I was back there. I could look at the images and say, this was the person in the cell on my right, on my left. I recalled every single instance of torture.
And Salah believes that he's in one of those photographs that a group of lawyers showed him later. It's a photograph shot from above of a man chained to a post inside of a cell. And in front of this man's body is a puddle of dark liquid, a vomit. It's exactly what Salah said happened to him.
I had told them all of these details, and they shocked me when they showed me this photo. And I told them, yes, this is it.
President Bush said today that he was disgusted by pictures of Iraqi prisoners being abused by American soldiers.
Their treatment does not reflect the nature of the American people.
You know, the scandal that was Abu Ghraib immediately kind of exposed the lie of a war of liberation, which is how the Bush administration had tried to justify the invasion. And 11 people, members of the American military, ultimately were charged or disciplined for their part in these abuses.
Four men are charged with maltreatment and indecent acts for
some went to prison,
battery, for shoving and stepping on detainees.
Salah watched these prosecutions and he couldn't but feel that this wasn't enough, going after a handful of American soldiers.
What you see in these pictures may reflect the actions of individuals, but by God, it doesn't reflect my army.
In fact, what we now know, what Salah now knows, is that responsibility started far further up the chain, and that there were others involved, including people who weren't members of the military, these civilians, people working for that company called Khaki.
Coming up, what happens when Salah tries to hold Khaki accountable for its role in Abu Ghraib? It's much harder than he'd ever imagined. And we'll speak with one of those private contractors who was there.
There's no excuse for me at the time having to have been able to look at those things and recognize that I didn't want to do them. But I did. And it frightened me how easy it was to cross that line. And it was an awful thing to do.
That's next.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
11 people. That's how many were charged or disciplined for the abuse Salah experienced and witnessed at Abu Ghraib. All of them members of the U.S. military. That's where public accountability stopped. But Salah knew there was a whole other group of people, people also responsible for his ordeal, who were never held to account. Seth Fried Wessler went to speak with one of them.
Hi, Eric.
A few months ago, I drove out to a house at the end of a quiet suburban street to meet Eric Fair.
I live in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Fair worked as an interrogator in American military prisons in Iraq.
Yeah, I'm an Army veteran.
Including Abu Ghraib. He got there just after Saleh was released.
I spend my days coaching Little League and cleaning the dishes. And
he's been remarkably open about what he was part of. He's spoken out, talked to the press. He wrote a book about his time working in Iraq when he was an employee of this private company called Khaki.
Of course, I get asked about Khaki.
And he says Abu Ghraib is a place he can't shake.
For me, it's sort of a movie that just keeps playing. And it's not something that happened 15 years ago. It's something that's happening right now.
Can you describe what you remember most physically about the place?
I do remember seeing the prisoners for the first time, and I was overwhelmed by the numbers. How many people we had put in prison. Abu Ghraib was filthy and poorly run. It was overcrowded. It was a violation of human morality, and it was a crime.
How did you, as a contractor, end up engaging in the kind of abuse or torture that you did? How did that happen?
I don't know. I've spent so many years thinking about how that happened and in some ways giving excuses. The big question is, if I had it to do over again, would I go back and do it differently? Would I change things? Of course I would, but I can't. It was who I was. I was someone who was willing to employ those types of techniques. They weren't things that I made up in my mind or that I created or I'd seen on TV. These were techniques that were written down and were instructed and described. And there's no excuse for me at the time having to have been able to look at those things and recognize that I didn't want to do them. But I did. And it frightened me how easy it was to cross that line. And it was an awful thing to do.
Fair came home from Iraq, returned to Pennsylvania, and he watched
leading the physical and sexual torture
as members of the U.S. military were tried and went to prison.
Sentenced Army Specialist Charles Grainer to 10 years in prison.
And he waited for somebody to come for him.
If there is a prosecutor out there that is going to make a case to prosecute Khaki or for any of his employees for torture, then I am the easiest case. The evidence is there, and I've done a really good job of making it really easy for someone to hold me responsible.
But nobody ever did. Nobody ever came to charge or prosecute the contractors, the civilian contractors, who'd been inside of Abu Ghraib and who Fair says did what they did.
I absolutely sympathize with the idea that a lot of people got away with a lot of awful things and that there should be some consequences. I mean, everyone on some level needs to be held accountable for what they did in war.
Fair believes that we all need to reckon, broadly and deeply as a country, with the wars we start and the violence we are responsible for. But holding Americans accountable for what they did in war is not so easy. There was one case that dragged on for more than a decade where federal prosecutors criminally charged employees of another contractor, Blackwater, for a massacre in Iraq. But for people like Saleh, a non-U.S. citizen living in a different country, pursuing any accountability on their own behalf, that's incredibly hard. And one of the main reasons for that is this doctrine called sovereign immunity. It's a weird carryover from British common law. It means the king can do no wrong. In the American version, it basically means, as a legal matter, the government can't be held liable for wrongdoing, even in Iraq, in a prison that the U.S. was in full control of. But there was something Saleh could do. He could file a civil lawsuit against the contractors who played a role in the abuses in Abu Ghraib.
We ready to go on?
He could sue Khaki.
Let's go on the record.
And so in 2008, a group of lawyers, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, did just that. They filed a lawsuit on behalf of Saleh and three other men who'd also been held in Abu Ghraib and like Saleh, who'd been released without charge.
This is the deposition of Suhail Najim Abdullah al-Shamari.
Suhail al-Shamari is one of the other plaintiffs in this case.
Would the witness please raise his right hand?
In his deposition, al-Shamari told the court what had happened to him.
He kept hitting me,
you know, hitting me all over my body.
On my face,
on my cheeks.
Like Saleh, he recalled terrible abuse and torture.
I'm going to ask our interpreter to please translate a statement that you made here. First, I will read it in English for the record. Plaintiff al-Shamari was subject to gratuitous and humiliating sexual touching when, on multiple occasions, guards forced him to bend over and inserted their fingers into his rectum. Did that happen at Abu Ghraib?
Naam.
Yes.
An investigation by the U.S. government of what had happened inside of Abu Ghraib.
Members of the committee, good morning all. I am Major General Antonio M. Taguba.
It actually said that at least one CACI employee had been part of making decisions about how detainees were interrogated there and instructed military police to abuse prisoners.
We gathered evidence pertaining to the involvement of several military intelligence personnel or contractors assigned to the 205th MI Brigade in the alleged detainee abuses at Abu Ghraib.
And members of the U.S. military who were put on trial over the violence at Abu Ghraib said on the stand that CACI employees had instructed them to abuse prisoners, which were damning allegations. Remember, Saleh had spent months unable to get anyone to fully believe what he had said happened to him.
I know CACI company was there. Interrogators were from CACI company. This was obvious, and we have evidence on this, which we filed in the court.
And so he and his lawyers, they felt like they had this very clear case of CACI's complicity in these well-documented abuses. That according to testimony and reports, the company had been part of making decisions about detainee treatment. And he and the other plaintiffs felt they'd finally be able to bring this story before an American judge in a U.S. court.
Seated.
But that's not exactly what happened.
All right, we're ready to proceed in al-Shamari versus CACI.
What happened is that right away, CACI began to fight the case against it, tooth and nail.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John O'Connor, and along with my co-counsel, Bill Dolan, we represent CACI in this appeal.
CACI, or CACI, tried out every argument it could think of to convince the court that since it was the federal government that had hired them, they're protected. And so far, for 12 whole years, it's managed to keep this case from going to trial.
The court has a number of different ways that it could resolve this case and end this case essentially here today.
No one, not even CACI, ever contested that Saleh was held at Abu Ghraib. But the company argued that whatever had happened to him there, he couldn't prove that CACI had anything to do with it.
The record does include some allegations, mostly in government reports, of discrete acts of misconduct, none of which I think would in any way qualify as torture.
This case has been going on quite a while.
It's been thrown out, reinstated, delayed, appealed repeatedly. But remarkably, it's still standing.
How much longer? What do you suggest are next steps?
I asked CACI for an interview. The company didn't respond, but it's strongly denied allegations of wrongdoing. In a past statement, it said, quote, "These lawsuits are completely without merit and designed to pursue a political agenda." And CACI tried another argument, too.
May it please the court. Judge Quattle.
Remember that idea, sovereign immunity. It's the idea that you can't sue the king. Well, CACI's lawyers put forward this other argument. They said that CACI had what they call derivative sovereign immunity. Effectively, the company's saying that they're operating like they're the king's arm, and they're under the control of the king's head. And if the king can't be sued, well, then you can't sue the king's arm. And CACI has taken this argument all the way to the Supreme Court. We're still waiting on the justices to decide if they're going to take this case. If they choose not to, then it might finally go to trial in front of a jury. But if they do take the case, for Saleh and the other plaintiffs, there's real reason to be concerned because of who now sits on the nation's highest bench.
I'm here today to tell the truth. I've never sexually assaulted anyone, not in high school, not in college, not ever.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who's lauded by conservatives, heard a very similar case when he was on the D.C. Circuit Court a decade ago.
01 et al. Saleh, an individual et al. versus CACI International.
Another case about U.S. military contractors, including CACI.
The treatment of prisoners in a war zone by U.S. military contractors could be governed by the enemy's law.
This case also dealt with accusations of torture at Abu Ghraib.
That one of the mechanisms in our system of American jurisprudence that keeps corporations abiding by the law is the specter of tort liability.
Any evidence of that?
And Kavanaugh, who was very skeptical of the detainees' arguments, threw out the case. The decision said when contractors are hired by the government to be part of a war, you can't sue them. And there's reason to think he would act in a similar way now, which, as Saleh himself recognizes, could prevent his case and others like it in the future from going to trial.
I think the law should be applied to individuals everywhere. Otherwise, this would give immunity to Americans to go outside the borders, commit heinous crimes, and there would be no consequences.
Once the sun finally set in Sweden, the night I went to visit Saleh and his family, we sat down for a meal.
Do you need the other chair?
No, this is okay.
Saleh and his wife Amal have waited and waited. The Iraq War and what happened to Saleh has completely uprooted this family.
The day we left Iraq, I knew inside that this was a farewell without return, that there was no going back, and the country was being broken, and that we wouldn't return.
Civil war, the rise of the Islamic State, skyrocketing unemployment, corruption, it's been a barrage. But for Saleh and Amal, their trauma doesn't go away. And amid all of this wreckage, they've stayed with this pursuit as it's ground forward and back in the American courts.
As they say, the road to reckoning is long. But the ultimate goal was that what happened to Saleh should never happen to anyone again. And that was the ultimate goal of this entire case.
For those of us who were never there, we have a way of very quickly putting things like Abu Ghraib behind us. For Saleh and people like him, there's been very little space to actually tell their stories. Saleh is still working as a journalist, filing freelance stories from Sweden. But when it comes to what happened to him, there are still real questions. For him, a big part of this case is about putting the facts on the table in an American court.
There is another point to be made, which is the memories will remain, but I can't have hate inside me. There could come a point where, as they say, the forgiver is generous, where the admission of guilt could come and where we say, okay, I forgive them.
To forgive, to heal, really, there's first got to be accountability. And 17 years after this war began, we're still a long way away from fully accounting for what was done in the name of safety. On the contrary, over the past year, CACI was awarded several new U.S. government and military contracts, potentially worth up to $3 billion in the coming years. The company is doing just fine, and many other companies are too. There have been a series of lawsuits like Saleh's filed against contractors, but they've all been thrown out or settled out of court. This one is the last one standing, and the last chance for Saleh and other victims of American abuses to force what happened to them back into public view. It's also the last chance for all of us to say, that was wrong. You cannot commit these kinds of abuses and just get away with it. Not in our name, not even when we're all terribly afraid. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. This episode was reported by Seth Fried Wessler, who is a Puffin Reporting Fellow with Type Media Center. It was produced and edited by Christopher Wirth, with editing help from Taki Telenidis, who's an editor with our partner podcast, Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And a special thanks to Ibrahim Hussein, Hanin Chakra, and Anjali Kamat. Our executive producer is Karen Froman. Casey Means is our technical director. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Jessica Miller, and Vera Lynn Williams, with help this week from Michelle Harris and Kim Nowaki. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. You can keep in touch with me by following me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thanks for listening.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.